Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. It was on the 23rd of November in the year 2000 that the Singapore Exchange would become the first exchange in Asia Pacific to list its own shares on its own stock market. I wonder what the thinking was there. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest financial results out of Harmony Gold, as well as out of the Industrial Development Corporation. We speak to the financial directors of both businesses, get a sense of how each business has fared. We also have a conversation with the team at Standard Bank, taking a look at the economic imperative that women form as part of the global economy and the African economies. We reflect on the impact that the African Women Impact Fund has been able to have through the support of the Standard Bank Group. Then we have a conversation with the Credit Association of South Africa, taking a look at how buy now, pay later facilities could potentially have an impact on your credit profile and how it is that we should be navigating those going forward. We wrap up the show, as we do every Thursday, with a small business conversation. We speak to the founder and CEO of a company called Curl Chemistry and get to know that business better.
The day's markets. Clear insights on today's winners, losers, and what to do next.
That's where we kick off the show, as we always do, with a sense of market movements that have been taking place throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by independent analyst Terence Hove to take a look at markets and see what we make of them. Terence, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Markets not doing too much today, I guess, depending on which markets you're looking at. Clearly, the focus is on the all-important Jackson Hole Symposium that kicked off today. We're expecting the main part of the symposium to be tomorrow when the US Fed Chair Kevin Warsh speaks there. Your thoughts around some of the market movements today?
Yeah, I think if we look at the weight, that's as you mentioned, you know, the focus in the market is turned over to, you know, the Jackson Hole Symposium. And I think, you know, given the roller coaster of you know, just the price action throughout the year to date, the you know, a lot of the market participants are going to be looking, you know, into the new US Fed chair first, you know, symposium speech in terms of even, you know, what the rates outlook is looking like. You know, we still have, you know, a market that is pretty much fragile to the shocks that are coming in, especially from a, you know, inflation concern. So I think, you know, the focus really comes in where it's crucial in terms of getting that underlying interest rate path, you know, in terms of what else, what data they're looking into. And subsequently, after this symposium, you've got that US Fed FOMC, you know, meeting coming up. So it really lines up the importance of this symposium, especially, you know, in the rates markets and, you know, being an underlying pricing factor, you know, in a lot of models and a lot of forecasting, you know, it becomes crucial to really gauge, you know, what the outlook is when we look at 2026, you know, and considering the shocks that are there in the market, you know, as we've seen through oil pricing in, and you know, you've seen that big rally as well coming in within the price of commodities. In particular, if you look at how gold has really captured that market sentiment in terms of, you know, how it's for that geopolitical risk, you know, within the market. So the symposium becomes crucial, you know, for the rates market to really price in, you know, what 2026 is looking at, you know, and prior to that FOMC meeting. So it is quite a big one, and you know, the US governor's initial or first meeting at the symposium, Kevin Warsh.
Terence, I know you keep an eye on the Bitcoin price. That seems to be one of the markets that has been moving quite a bit. Market at the moment just shy of the 1.3 million rand mark, almost a little over half of what the a kilogram of gold price would be at current levels. The Bitcoin price actually doing relatively well considering how under pressure it's been for the majority of the year.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite an interesting asset class, you know, and also if you look at that Bitcoin and gold comparison, if you look at it from a volatility perspective, as you've mentioned, Bitcoin has been well under pressure, you know, for much of, 2026. And on the upside, you've seen that gold has performed considerably well. You know, in terms of the pricing of gold, and again being a good gauge of that geopolitical flare points and flare ups, so you see, you know, that investor flow, especially when you look at, for example, Bitcoin and its speculative nature, and including that institutional buy into that asset class. So now the Bitcoin is recovering. You're seeing that price level stacking up, and of course gold is still, you know, elevated. I mean, it's still capturing good levels. It's come quite a long way, and so at this point, of 2026, I think, yeah, gold is really, you know, as an asset class, really captured that sentiment in terms of, you know, even that investor flow capturing that geopolitical sentiment, to be specific, and of course now you're seeing that recovery coming into Bitcoin, and of course, you know, with that speculative nature in terms of that investor flow, that comfort in terms of going into a more riskier asset as a crypto, you know, as some would classify it. So I think that's that investor flow that's also being captured between the two instruments.
Terence, can we take a look at international markets, the sentiment there? I mean, US markets at the moment are in the green, but European markets kind of struggling along through the day. Asian markets, a bit of a mixed bunch. Equities really not doing the best this week, but I suppose they have had their time in the sun. They have been running as well, so best could be relative to at the time that you're looking at the market.
Yeah. I mean, and a good gauge of the market sentiment is if you look at our own South African rand in terms of how it is faring, is a gauge within those markets, because again, you know, rand strength is showing, you know, strong investor inflow in South Africa as well. I mean, there's that aspect of the rand in terms of the value, and it captures, and, you know, as a barometer, so to speak, you know, of investor flow. So when you see the rand strengthening, you know, where, you know, other markets, you know, it mixed bag, as you've mentioned, that shows that, you know, as a destination, you're seeing quite a lot of inflow into, you know, South Africa as a destination. So, and I mean, one of the big factors, as we mentioned earlier on, if we look at, you know, where the commodity such as gold has been for much of 2026, that's very strong figures that we're looking, you know, in terms of, you know, the resource sector, and I'm you know, that's been quite a strong pricing that has come through when you've seen that push in the price of gold. So that would benefit the South African rand considerably, you know, also being quite an exporter into the market. So, and, you know, as a commodity on demand, as I mentioned earlier, you know, capturing that geopolitical risk sentiment. So I think, you know, when we look at the markets and we look at, you know, the strength of the rand, you just see how that story, you know, connects in terms of, as South Africa in comparison to the other markets.
Markets are reporting some good numbers at the moment, I suppose. depending on which markets you are particularly looking at, we'll take the win. That is the Rand remaining below 16 Rand as we head towards the weekend Jackson Hole Symposium. All the eyes are on US and other central banks as they meet around the world, as they meet in Wyoming to take a look at how it is that they might be charting out future policies. Independent analyst Terence Hove joining us to take a look at markets and try and make sense of them.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think NetBank Commercial Banking. See money differently. NetBank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Did you know? A soil sample gives you a comprehensive understanding of your soil. Through soil, sap, and leaf analysis, Omnia helps turn data into practical, producer-relevant recommendations. Because when you understand your soil properly, you can make better decisions in the field. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
Hi, I need irrigation funding for my farm.
Something that tracks moisture across the farm and rotates your crops.
Well,
a plus sensors that read your soil, reduce waste, and send water exactly where it's needed.
I was thinking basic irrigation, but financing
for a smart farming system
is actually what I need.
At NetBank, we see more. From regenerative agriculture to smart farming solutions, we help agribusinesses think bigger. Think NetBank Commercial Banking. See money differently. NetBank. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
Harmony Gold, one of South Africa's largest gold producers, has reported their results for their financial year end. That is, of course, the financial year ended 30 June 2026. There is a final dividend there. There is a net income figure that has almost doubled. And there is a headline earnings figure that is quite eye-watering to any investor. We're going to be taking a look at these numbers in a bit more detail with the financial director at Harmony Gold, Mebuipulo Lukubo. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of their performance. Mebuipulo, always lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. It's even better to be able to catch up at the end of a successful financial year, thankful to the gold price for doing its part, even though, especially given that the business was able to do its own part in maintaining its all-in sustained costs within guidance. How do you reflect on the year that was from a management perspective?
Thank you. Firstly, good evening to your listeners. Thank you for having me. Yeah, financial year 26 was really an outstanding year for Harmony. I'd peg it down really driven by disciplined operational delivery. We had strong margin expansion and, as you mentioned, very strong commodity prices. So it was the 11th consecutive financial year that we delivered on gold production guidance, as well as other key operational guidance metrics. Again, as you mentioned, all-in sustaining cost coming in line with guidance, as well as our underground recovered gold grade, also within guidance. So all in all, really that combination, and then on top of that, the addition of copper in our portfolio really rounded up the year for us.
Mebuipulo, let's take a look at that copper addition. You and I spoke about it when we caught up around the interim numbers to say it was quite the strategic decision from a business perspective. And we said we'd look to see how it is that that has filtered into the business as part of a broader strategy. Take me through the impact that that has had in this particular year and what it's been able to do for the balance sheet.
So I'll firstly start with CSA, which is an in-production operation that we closed last year, October 25. So that integration into our portfolio was successful. The mine produced 200,000 tons of copper during the 8 months that it was under Harmony's ownership at a very good recovered grade of 3.75%. So also coming in within guidance. From a cash cost perspective, that was $2.47 a pound, also below guidance. So all in all, that mine generated 781 million rand towards our free cash flow. So, you know, slowly starting to trickle in is a hill to climb in terms of what we've guided copper production to be in about 3 years' time when we have both CSA and our project Eva Copper up and running.
Melikova, can we take a look at the strategic shift from a business perspective at the moment? Up to this point, portfolio progression and improvement have been the key priorities or the key focus areas. We are now stepping into a new era for the business where execution and value unlock start to become that much more important in how the business moves into this next phase. I imagine that stretches across both the gold portfolio, the copper portfolio, and any other assets that then come into the business. How do we see the next couple of years shaping up, understanding that the global macros may currently be in your favor, but we never know how much longer that's going to be on for?
So gold really remains the foundation of the business, if that's first and foremost. And what copper has done is that it's adding that increased resilience to the portfolio. So we invested in copper. Firstly, it's that counter-cyclical and geographic diversification. But you're also seeing, which we have guided for quite some time, a gold gap in production that comes from our Moab Khotsong operation, which is one of our high-grade operations. So the move was strategic, and it's aimed, as I said, into that diversification and really improving the overall portfolio of the business. So we anticipate, or what we're estimating given current planning, that copper will make up to about 30% of production by the, let's call it 10 years, by FY36. It's difficult to estimate now contribution on a revenue line, as I mean, these are factors out of our control, commodity prices and the like, but that is where we see the business going. So we say, at the moment, we're actually the only South African gold producer with meaningful copper exposure. So I think from an investment case, that differentiates us quite a bit from our peers.
Melikova, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the management decisions and the balancing act that comes with being in such a good position. Yes, there was a slight decline of around 3% in the output from a gold perspective, but the business still being able to benefit from the likes of your Papua New Guinea operations, and overall still being able to come back to shareholders and to the market and say, here's $500 million worth of dividend. How does the business then look to maintain that balance and say, whilst we have the ability to reward shareholders, we still have a long-term objective and a strategic objective to think about, and we can't be too reckless or we can't be too loose in how it is we approach our strategy?
It's very much always a balancing act, I must say. I mean, we understand investors' concerns around a higher capital expenditure profile, but I think the key point is that we invest, or rather that the investment cycle is necessary for us to sustain and improve the business. Mining by its nature is a depleting industry, so we continuously have to replace reserves, extend mine lives, etc. So for us, it's not really a choice between shareholder returns and investment, or between gold and copper, but it's rather just that in continuing investment that is essential to ensure that we're able to deliver both to shareholders at the end of the day. So we were quite pleased that we were able to return a significant dividend this time around. But I think, you know, it's important that we were able to do that not despite of, instead of, but alongside the growth that we are also delivering.
These things go hand in hand from a business operating perspective. It's important to contain costs. It's important to drive strategy. It's important to reward shareholders. And somewhere along the way, the management team has to find a way to keep all of these important factors in perfect harmony. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Harmony Gold's financial director, Boipelo Lekubo, joining us to take a look at the performance of their business over the previous financial year and how it is that that strategy continues to drive forward.
In case you're on the highway, driving to your first big maize delivery and something mysterious happens, you stop at the garage to scope the damage, you realize the fuel system is kinda dear my car. You panic, but then you take a deep breath because you know Hino Care Gap Cover is there to cover anything outside the standard 6-year warranty. From steering columns to ABS control modules, it's the unseen essential in your business. Speak to your Hino dealer. T's and C's apply. Hino, all the way.
Hi, I need irrigation funding for my farm.
Something that tracks moisture across the farm and rotates your crops?
Well,
Plus sensors that read your soil, reduce waste, and send water exactly where it's needed.
I was thinking basic irrigation, but financing
for a smart farming system
is actually what I need.
At NetBank, we see more. From regenerative agriculture to smart farming solutions, we help agribusinesses think bigger. Think NetBank Commercial Banking. See money differently. NetBank. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The Industrial Development Corporation released its own sets of financial results for the financial year ended March 2026. Development Finance Institute saw a significant loss of 4.6 billion rand for this particular financial year. This is a big swing from the 329 million rand profit that they saw in the previous year and almost 7.5 billion rand profit of 2024. We're going to be taking a look at this year's performance in greater detail with the IDC's Chief Financial Officer, Isaac Malevo, who joins me on the line now to see what we make of their performance. Isaac, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. A difficult set of numbers to report on, I suppose, if we look at it in isolation, but that is not what we're going to be doing. The year being obviously the sum of moving parts. Your initial thoughts around how it is that the year played out for the IDC?
Listeners, indeed, it's always a pleasure catching up with you. Yes, we did release our annual results. And perhaps let me start off just by saying that at a company level, and that is the IDC company, we reported a profit of 2.3 billion, which is about 27% up compared to the prior year. And of course, as you have alluded, when we move to group, we now have to take into account our key subsidiaries, such as Fosco, and also look at our associate companies, such as Mozal. Both of these two entities, Fosco and Mozal, Fosco reported a loss of 2.8 billion. Mozal, the share of our loss after Mozal was put on care and maintenance, they incurred a significant impairment, and they reported a loss of over 10 billion. And our share of that is about 2.6 billion. So if you add the two, it does show you how it contributes significantly from moving to a profit of 2.3 to a loss of 4.7. Having said that, the Fosco challenges, Fosco is important to the country and the IDC. They produce fertilizer products, but to do that, they need ammonia and phosphoric acid. And because their inputs are largely imported, they were severely affected in the latter part of the year by the geopolitical tensions. They had some of their input stuck in the Strait of Hormuz. That's the first thing. The second thing, their production was affected internally by the flooding that happened in the beginning of the year. And also they had a fatality. And they had to suspend their operations for more than 5 weeks, which then affected their production. And all of these factors contributed to their operating losses. And that's why they find themselves where they are. We are supporting them, and we're looking at a turnaround to see how we can further support them. The second part on the Mozal. The Mozal, as you know, is currently on care and maintenance. South 32 is looking at potential strategic partners to either take the asset. As IDC, we have a preemptive right. So we are also exploring our options, whether to exercise the preemptive right and to see whether we can resuscitate that asset. And that's because, again, it's largely on the back of energy prices. And to the extent that we can resolve that, we think that asset can be brought back to life.
Isaac, take us through the IDC's investment strategy and investment thesis. You touched on the fact that an asset like Fosco is a critical asset in the agricultural landscape. We know that other assets, the likes of the IDC's investment or conversations with ArcelorMittal South Africa, represent a critical conversation in the steel sector. How does the IDC balance between what is an economic objective and a national objective versus a profitable and worthwhile investment? Because surely that balancing act is potentially the most difficult for the business.
No, absolutely. So we have to play a role that supports our mandate. And our mandate is that of supporting the industrialization of the country, which is developmental. But in doing so, we have to be financially sustainable as an organization. We tend to take an approach of not just investing in a particular transaction. We look at the value chain, and that's really been our approach. So let's take the steel sector as an example. And you did mention AMSA being one of those companies affected in the steel industry. Our approach is that to the extent that the closure or any disruption in either AMSA or any of the steel companies has an effect of impacting on the downstream, which is the car manufacturing subsector, because those are the ones who depend on the likes of AMSA, the likes of SCOR, or any of these steel companies. So we then take a view that we have to make sure that the entire ecosystem, the value chain, is not affected, and to what extent is it important and strategic to the country. So in our view, the steel sector remains critical to South Africa. And because of that, we have to support the steel sector. And it's critical because we know there's Eskom grid expansion that's happening, that's going to happen. There's other infrastructure projects to the tune of 3 trillion that will be happening. And those infrastructure projects will need steel. And to the extent that as a country we believe we cannot be vulnerable to the global market forces when it comes to steel. And someone might argue there is an oversupply of steel, but we also recognize that as a country, we need to be certain that we can localize the manufacturing and the production of the key of the steel as we need it for our infrastructure projects.
Isaac, speaking of that localization, how does the IDC then see its role potentially continuing to unfold or transitioning if we look at the South African story in particular? You touched on the National Transmission Company of South Africa and the role that the IDC looks to play in those efforts. But we also know that from an industrialization perspective, from an economic growth perspective, South Africa should be doing a lot better than what it is now, and I can imagine that the lack of economic growth then starts to put different pressures on the IDC as a business, and surely the IDC cannot carry all of the projects by itself. Yeah. How then do you as an organization start to balance the mandate that you so clearly mentioned being given by the shareholder and what it is that makes practical sense from a day-to-day operations perspective?
Absolutely, it's a good question. We have submitted to our shareholder representative, Minister Honorable Minister Pakstau. There's also submission made to the National Treasury. And we are exploring some form of instrument that will support our developmental mandate, whether it's in a form of a recapitalization or a form of some guarantee, which can be explicit, or some form of support that talks to recognition that we have to be financially sustainable as an organization whilst fulfilling our mandate. And having said that, there is also an exploration of whether we can get things like a tax exemption status, which also assists us in terms of using some of that capital to support the mandate of the IDC. And that's, these are all the propositions that are before our shareholder and are being considered very carefully. So we believe that that will certainly assist us to play our development mandate whilst becoming financially sustainable. And of course, we do have a good book, and I must emphasize that. We're still on board very good clients who are performing. So that also helps to cushion some of the credit losses we see when it comes to this investment that support developmental objectives.
Isaac, let's wrap up the conversation by looking at that book, because the IDC has in the past and will, I suppose, continue to in future, invested beyond the borders of South Africa. That means you've exposed the organization to global factors, whether willingly or unwillingly. So how does the IDC look at its local portfolio versus its international portfolio?
Yeah, no, thank you. So currently we are sitting around 15% of our portfolio is outside South Africa. We did get the money to increase that exposure to about 30% on the back of supporting the Africa Continental Free Trade, which then talks to also our ambition to support the regions around South Africa, but also recognizing that there are South African companies who are investing outside South Africa. And when we're doing that, working alongside with the DFIs, the continental DFIs such as AFDB, AfriExim, and DBSA, just to make sure that we are able to collaborate in a way that has maximum impact. But we're not going to do that without being cognizant of the credit risk. So we also are mindful of the countries we're investing in. So we look at the country risk. And to the extent that it's within our risk appetite, we'll certainly invest in those countries. So we are very much optimistic about the development that needs to happen outside South Africa, mainly in the continent.
Optimistic about the African continent, a continent that the IDC has been a part of since 1940. We'll have to leave the conversation on that particular note. Chief Financial Officer of the Industrial Development Corporation of South Africa, Isaac Malevu, joining us to take a look at the performance of the IDC over the last financial year and how it is that they're looking at their portfolio in the new year.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. As we wrap up Women's Month, we have been reflecting on the importance of having women in the economy and the critical role that they play in not just our economy, but in the global economy. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Executive Head of Strategic Partnerships for Global Markets at Standard Bank's Corporate and Investment Banking. She also happens to be the chair of the African Women Impact Fund, Melindeka Dzeze. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Lindeka, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. For many years, we've had conversations around gender inclusion and achieving social mandates, but more and more we're realizing that those conversations don't speak to the fundamental fact that women are not just a gender inclusion in economic objectives. They're an economic imperative.
Absolutely, sir. And this is important because if you look at the whole space where we are, traditionally, when you look at investment success, it's always been measured through financial returns, revenue, profitability, and market share. But while these metrics remain important, we are now in a world shaped by technological disruptions, demographic change, climate pressures, and evolving societal expectations. And the question we should be asking is whether we are directing capital towards the long-term drivers of sustainable growth. So when we look at the way women are, it's always been looked at as more as a social impact story, even though that is true. I mean, we cannot minimize the social benefits. They're undeniable. But the more compelling case for me is on the economic side of it. When you look at capital that is directed towards women-led businesses or entrepreneurs in the investment ecosystem, we have the potential to expand our markets. We create more jobs. We stimulate innovation. And there's a general broad, we generate broader economic multiplier effects. And this has been proven by data. And also on the continent, well, globally, women entrepreneurs in Africa lead. This is by IFC's research. They're about 24 to 26% of entrepreneur activity. And Africa leads in that space. And not only that, they are the creators of jobs. If you look at the SMEs, women-led businesses, and the rest, they create more jobs than your large-scale private companies. And that's why we cannot overlook this. And they're a bigger part of it. They're an asset that the continent actually has to look at and invest in.
Lindeka, if we know all of the data, if we have all of the facts, why is it that it's still so difficult for women on the African continent and women around the world that are entrepreneurs to access capital that they so desperately need? If we know that they provide a good return on investment, they enable economies and create jobs. Where is the gap between financing them and them contributing towards the economy?
I think when we answer that, I think broadly what we first need to look at is that many traditional investment models were not designed to recognize the realities of emerging markets, informal economies, and underserved sectors. As a result, they can overlook businesses and entrepreneurs with significant growth potential. And this is where we think expanding our understanding of investment intelligence does not mean leaving or lowering standards. It means developing better ways of identifying future value. And most of Africa's economic dynamism exists in places that conventional investment approaches can struggle to see. This is women-owned enterprises. This is growing SMEs. You're talking about local innovators and entrepreneurs building businesses under challenging conditions. So often their contribution extends beyond what conventional value models capture. And that's what we need to look at. We cannot be looking, the traditional models were not designed with us in mind. And I think that's where we need to really look at this.
Lindeka, speaking of those contributions, I want to take a look at the Africa Women Impact Fund, a fund that you currently chair, a fund that Standard Bank, the largest bank on the continent by assets, has contributed, has committed more than $10 million towards. And I want to look at that as just but one initiative that has the potential to catalyze the change that we're talking about here. Take us through kind of what that fund has been able to realize as an initiative, but broadly what it's also taught us around how it is that we do need to approach these financing conversations differently.
I think this whole conversation is actually is a philosophy that informed this bank's investment into this fund. And the objective was not merely to support women-owned businesses, but to strengthen the investment ecosystem by backing these fund managers that have deep local market knowledge and the ability to identify and scale opportunities across Africa. But not only are we fund looking to get money for them to manage money at scale, but we actually have the foundation that allows them. It's a hard journey to raise capital, and you still need to keep lights on. And these women employ the youth. They actually have, those we've funded have actually been able to grow their businesses and employ more people. And some of them have become clients of the bank. So what we've done is actually say, what is that they need? So it's actually looking at the entire ecosystem that they need. While they're fundraising, there's the money that they need to actually be driving and paying investment licensing, getting ESG frameworks. And for us, this approach is not only speaking to, it extends beyond capital deployment. It demonstrates what becomes possible when we invest not only in businesses, but the entire ecosystem that enables businesses to grow. So what we're looking at now is that the right capital deployed through the right investment structures can unlock participation, strengthen markets, create employment, and support sustainable growth, which for me is one that we cannot overlook. If we are serious about accelerating growth on this continent, we cannot ignore a large share of the continent's productive capacity.
The continent has a productive capacity that is growing. The continent has women entrepreneurs that are making an impact and making a tangible difference towards its future. It is these women and entrepreneurs that we need to continue to support, not simply because it is Women's Month, but because the data verifies that they keep the economies of our continent going. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note. Executive Head of Strategic Partnerships for Global Markets at Standard Bank's Corporate and Investment Banking, also the chair of the African Women Impact Fund, Lindeka Dzedze, joining us to take a look at the role that women entrepreneurs play on the African continent and how it is that they need to be supported. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
Sure, it's great knowing my net worth's denominated in dollars, euros, pounds, and rands, but that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. This is surprising my bro in the States on his birthday.
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get an offshore account with 4 currency options and pay no monthly maintenance fees. Search Standard Bank Private for more. Standard Bank, it can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The National Credit Regulator has updated its reporting codes as it relates to information sharing. This has some serious implications on service providers like those that offer buy now, pay later facilities, because the new reporting standards could mean that your borrowings are reported as part of your credit score assessments. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Chief Executive Officer of the Credit Association of South Africa, Leonie van Pletsen. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Leonie, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with an overview of what prompted the National Credit Regulator to make these adjustments.
So I think the growth of the BNPL products in South Africa, we've seen significant growth. And I think traditional credit providers, you know, needs visibility of those repayment obligations. And that is why the Credit Association actually advocated for the data to be uploaded on the credit bureau so that the credit providers has visibility of a consumer's expenses.
Leonie, how do these new adjustments have the potential to impact consumers that make use of these buy now, pay later facilities? What has been the norm up to this point, and what would the new adjustments mean?
So usually when a consumer entered into a BNPL agreement, there was no visibility on any form of credit bureau so that other traditional credit providers could have visibility of this. So what's happening now is the NCR is saying, because this industry is so big, they require reporting to take place. So now when a consumer enters into a BNPL agreement, that data would be visible to other credit providers as well, so that they can assess the affordability of the consumer to make sure that they can pay all of their debt obligations. So usually it wouldn't have an impact on your credit bureau reporting, but now there will be a visible account type that will tell other credit providers how many BNPL products you have and if you are up to date with your payments.
Leonie, this certainly has the potential to have some implications on how it is that lenders view you as a prospective borrower in the future. From a lending perspective, what is the practice around the information sharing that would benefit buy now, pay later service providers to adhere to these adjustments?
So this will definitely have an impact on credit providers, because we will now see if a client is already over indebted or if they can actually afford to repay all of their repayments. So this is an additional bureau submission that a credit provider has to take into account when they are determining their expenses. Now, this is important for consumers, because consumers must now make sure that they repay these repayments on time so that it doesn't affect their payment score negatively. We are very happy that this is taking place so that we can have a full picture of the consumer's total obligations.
Leonie, what does this then mean for the credit scores overall? You touched on the fact that
yes,
it affects payment behaviors and how it is that prospective service providers might view those behaviors. Does it have a material impact on the actual credit score of consumers?
So all of the credit providers have different credit scores and mechanisms that they use. This will only merely increase your expenses, you know, if you have a couple of BNPL products. So if you are stacking the products, making use of three or four different BNPL providers, credit providers will now be able to see this and will determine if you can actually afford formal credit. And BNPL at this stage is not regulated, so they don't do an affordability assessment. However, normal credit providers registered with the NCR has to do an affordability calculation. So this will be taken into consideration when they are doing their affordability calculations.
Leona, in your opinion, is this the next step towards getting buy now, pay later service providers to be more formally regulated? I mean, we do know that from a credit perspective, as you rightly mentioned, this does have an impact on formal credit, even if this might be considered informal credit at the stage.
Yes, I think this is definitely the next step for them to become more regulated. And we would advocate not for over-regulation, but at least for a National Credit Act affordability assessment to take place, so that when we do our affordability, they do the affordability in the same way to make sure that the consumer is not over-indebted. Because we don't want the consumer to make use of different BNPL products and then actually go out and seek formal credit in order to pay those products. So a step in the right direction. I don't think reporting is the only mechanism that will solve this problem, but I think the next regulations is on its way.
moving in the right direction towards ensuring that South Africans don't find themselves over indebted. This is the next step from the National Credit Regulator's perspective, having buy now, pay later service providers report on the activities of their consumers so that all other service providers are also able to share in that information. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Chief Executive Officer of the Credit Association of South Africa, Leonie van Pletzen, joining us to take a look at how it is that making use of buy now, pay later services could potentially impact your credit score.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
SME of the Week is powered by Capitec Business Banking. Start out or scale up with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply. It is SME of the Week time, the part of the show where we get to showcase a small business to you, our SAFM community, a business that is doing well, a business that could do even better with your help and your support. This week's small business is a company called Curl Chemistry, and I'm joined on the line by the company's founder and CEO, Liesel Smurden, to take a look at her business and see how she built it. Liesel, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about Curl Chemistry. How did you build this business and why did you build the business?
Hi there, and thank you so much for having me. So I started Curl Chemistry from a personal experience where for years I was straightening my hair throughout high school, and I came across a picture of myself with beautiful curly hair. I was about 10 years old sitting in front of my mom's dressing table, and that inspired me to go back to natural and create a range of products. But obviously it started off small, so I only had one product and it just blew up from there basically.
Liesel, take us through the journey and how it is that you got to where you are today, because you mentioned that you started off with one product. And as I look through the online store now, there's a whole range. There's travel size products. There's different stockists. Take me through how it is that you kind of found your sweet spot in terms of the products you wanted to create and how you then just kind of kept growing the business.
Yeah, so it obviously started off first tested on my family and my friends. And they really loved the product. And then we launched our first product, which was the Curl Activating Cream back in 2016. I only had one product when I launched, and I only had a Facebook page, and I only had 5,000 Rand that my dad borrowed me for my first batch of products. And once we launched, there was such a huge demand for curly hair products in the market at the time. So I figured that a lot of other ladies must be going through the exact same transition as me. And that's what inspired the growth of the brand. We then went on to making shampoos and conditioners and sprays and oils. So it was really driven by the demand of the curly hair community. And that's how we grew.
So Liesel, 10 years later today, take us through what it is that you have in your range, because I see now you've gone beyond just products. You have accessories as well that you have on your website. Take us through how you went from just one cream to everything that you have now.
So basically, we saw that so many curls are different, so unique. So we couldn't just create one product for one type of curl. We know that as South Africans, we have different nationalities and mixes of people. So we wanted to cater for all our curly girls, whether it was a different type of curl. We know that there are different types of curls out there. So we wanted to include everybody. So that's why we have such a huge variety of products. Some of our products are more for your scalp and treatment of the scalp. Others are for moisturizing the curls. Others are for defining the curls. So it was really, we wanted to cater to all of our curly ladies and families, actually, because our products are family friendly, kid friendly. So we really wanted it to be inclusive of all.
Speaking of catering to everybody, Liesel, what gave you the idea of saying, I want to make them travel sized? Because that's something that in this industry, a lot of people can easily overlook. Everybody can think about,
yes,
going into kind of retail outlets and all of that, but making it travel size is a level of convenience that South Africans absolutely would love.
Yes, definitely. Obviously, you don't want to commit to a big product not working. So we wanted to offer people a smaller size where they could test out the product first. And if they liked it, they would obviously then purchase a bigger size. But also for when traveling, it is nice to have a small little product on the go, especially like one of our products that we have, Curl Refreshing Spray. Take it out of your bag and spray it wherever you are. So I think it's just convenience as well.
And that convenience, I, for one, would greatly appreciate as somebody who travels and struggles with remembering that liquids must be 100 mils or less. Liesl, let's take a look at your hopes and dreams for this business. You've been able to build this business. You've been at it for 10 years. You've built it from nothing, as you've told us. Where do you want to see the business going next?
I think we would just like to grow the business sustainably, grow the range, obviously, cater to more. We also want to obviously prepare ourselves for that growth. So basically making our warehouse and our resources ready for that growth. And just, yeah, including so many more products, more. We want to make it a one-stop shop basically for the whole family.
Liesl, where is that one-stop shop? How do people get hold of the business? Where can people find your products? I know there's an online store. Give us all the details for that. And most importantly, where people can reach Curl Chemistry.
Yeah, so I forgot to mention that Checkers was our biggest distributor for the last 2 years. I got the opportunity to distribute in Checkers stores in the Western Cape, which was a fantastic opportunity for me as a small business. It took such a long time to actually get to retail. I was rejected quite a few times. I could actually say 8 years of the 10 years that we were in business, I was rejected. And Checkers saw that potential in me. So they decided to range 9 of my products. And they currently are in about 15 stores at the moment in the Western Cape. So that's fantastic. People can go to our website to see the Checkers stores that are stocking the products. And yeah, they can also look on our website. Our full range is there. Obviously, Checkers is ranging 9 of our products. We have a bigger range, but we are going to definitely expand that.
Liesl, one more time, those website details before I let you go.
My website details are www.curlchemistry.co.za. Our full catalogue is available over there, but also our 9 products are available at selected Checkers stores in the Western Cape. And yeah, that's where you can find us.
For all those with curly hair and looking to maintain that hair, the team at Curl Chemistry have got you covered. All the best to you, Liesl, and your business. We love to see the businesses that do well and continue to support South African communities. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Founder and Chief Executive Officer at Curl Chemistry, Liesl Smerdon, joining us for this week's SME. Inspired by the SME of the week? Start your own business or scale up and save up to 50% on fees with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're running a business, you know this sound. That's growth. Another customer. Money in the bank. Why should your business slow down for your bank? With Capitec Business, it doesn't. You get lower fees, faster credit approvals, and bankers who know your business. Now that's progress. Bank on better with Capitec Business Banking. Capitec is an authorized credit provider, FSP 46669. Initiation, service fees, and conditions apply.
That's the update for the show, folks. That's the update for the week. It is coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Coase and the SFM News team are standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by the top sport team. From my side, good night.